how much of an application change would it take from supplying power to a grid, say in China, and then getting it over to warm up the waters ahead of a location you'd like a hurricane to go?
Actually, there's no difference whatsoever. All you have to do is aim the beam. And we can easily treat the globe like a map using GPS coordinates or geometric coordinates and limit the places the beam can be aimed to. There are a number of ways of putting a very simple mechanical stop in a system that prevents it from operating in a method you wouldn't want it to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that every safety precaution will be taken because there will be such an uproar if anything were to happen.
Oh, big uproar.
It was dangerous.
Yes.
And rightly so. The system of this magnitude and this power does need to be regulated properly.
Well, all, nuclear power plants, even domestic power plants, they all have rules.
That's right.
Right, they operate by. And this would be, even in the case of an accident of some sort, and you've got to always imagine they could happen, you're suggesting it would be far less traumatic than a nuclear accident, let's say.
Oh, sure. I mean, at any time, somebody can just throw the switch and turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
And understand these are going to be manned stations, because with the building of this new launch vehicle, there's a very important difference between it and the traditional space shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
This launch vehicle is designed to use the external tanks as laboratories and working spaces, manufacturing spaces.
Of course.
And so instead of throwing away the tank every time you take a launch, this tank would end up in orbit and part of an orbital station. And eventually, there would be as many as 500 people working on each of these stations. So there will be on-orbit crews that will do the work and the support and do the construction. So you'll always have somebody who has the ability to turn the switch off. This isn't going to be some untended thing flapping about like a chicken with his head cut off. It's going to be very well operated and tended.
And Sir Charles, here's a sort of a technical question. Between the satellite that gathers and then beams back to Earth this microwave energy, you have to pass through the good old atmosphere.
That's correct.
And with what efficiency would the energy be transferred to the ground station? Would it be 100%? Would every bit of energy that you transmit from the satellite reach the ground station?
It won't be 100%, but the estimates show that the amount of energy that's transferred from the beam, if it's properly tuned to a frequency that passes through our atmosphere, the amount of energy, that the heating that occurs would be less than the heating from the light of the full moon, about a hundredth of a degree centigrade.
A hundredth of a degree centigrade?
Very, very tiny amount.
That would, what are you talking about? The immediate air would heat to that degree?
That's right. The air directly over it would be 1/100, just 1% of 1 degree centigrade difference at the most.
Boy, that's not much. So there's
almost indetectable.
There's almost no loss to speak of then.
There is some loss, but the loss ends up as heat in the wires, heat in your conversion system, that sort of thing.
So those people that would march up and down with signs saying you're causing global warming would be wrong.
They'd be absolutely wrong, because to generate the power in space, none of the process heat is radiated on the planet, only the power itself. So per kilowatt hour, an orbital solar station will generate far less heat than a power plant would on the ground. And, of course, there's no pollution being exhausted in the atmosphere, so we're way ahead on both counts.
What would the life of the satellite be? I mean, you would virtually have microwave-generating power tubes, big power tubes, right?
That's correct. And they would be modular and easy to replace and recondition right on orbit. So the lifetime of the station is, how quickly can your crew replace a part that burns out? You'd have constant maintenance going on, and part of it would be automated or robotic, and part of it would be by human beings. And that raises another interesting question about why the insurance companies would fund this. I mentioned earlier that they own $15 billion of useless satellites in orbit.
Mm-hmm.
One of the tasks that we are going to offer is the ability to recondition those satellites and refuel them so the insurance companies can sell them back as services to the ground. In other words, they'll recover that $15 billion that they've invested as a write-off. They'll get that capacity back.
This sounds really good. In a project of this size and magnitude, I'm sure that you've had brain sessions just sitting down trying to shoot holes. You know, where is going to be the hole in our idea?
We have tried to find everything that could go wrong.
And?
We've come out empty-handed pretty much. The human factor is the real problem that we have to deal with. We have to have trustworthy people, as in any operation.
Sure.
It comes down to the human factor. We're not worried about radiation. We're not worried about impacts. The collectors themselves are coated silver plastic, and if a meteorite were to go through a meteor, a grain of sand, or a piece of hardware, it'd punch a little hole in it and it'd keep going.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't affect the operation at all. And the generators are designed so that they work in tandem. If you're using turbines, for instance, you'd have one spinning clockwise and one spinning counterclockwise right next to each other. This would eliminate torque forces that make your satellite tend to twist around. So we've tried to cover, if one of those generators fails, what happens? Well, there's a whole network of generators spread out over the surface of this generator, of this system, and one of them being hit or destroyed would simply mean that one got shut down immediately, and the rest of the grid would pick up the slack. Everything would be modular, everything compartmentalized, and everything backed up. Multiple redundancy is the key, just like all the cells in your body being redundant.
So you think that the governments would be... You don't think there's going to be any resistance, for example, on the part of the U.S. government when China becomes the first real customer?
Well, they have a choice. They can let China burn fossil fuels and create substantially more pollution than even we are generating now.
Yes.
Or they can go along this plan with this plan and the Kyoto Accord, and they can allow everyone to be in compliance and use clean energy.
Well, if China got it going, wouldn't a scream go up that how can you do this for the Chinese and why aren't you doing it for us?
Because it comes down to who pays for the job to be done. If people in this country can get the government to support the funding for building these things through commercial or private industry, that's fine. Or if private industry finds a market in this country, that's fine. It's all going to depend on who invests their money in it, because the investors get their payoff.
Well, maybe I guess I should ask why you think the Chinese are willing to pony up the money when the U.S. government apparently is not.
One of them is the negotiations that are going on. And a response is expected next month, as a matter of fact, because if they commit by April, they are planning on announcing at the next Kyoto meeting, which I think is in May, what they are planning to do, and that would be orbital solar power. Once they've made that announcement, you know what's going to happen.